From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We're coming to the end of the week-long music marathon known as CMJ. CMJ is all about looking ahead to see who the next buzzed-about bands will be. I'm looking forward to bringing you a terrific Australian group called Little May. They have a jangly folk-pop thing going on that doesn't quite hide a bit of darkness underneath. So they'll play live for us in just a little while. But first, we will actually look back. Because this year is the 30th anniversary of Def Jam, the record label that helped define hip-hop, and therefore the sound of global pop. Co-founder Russell Simmons will join us to tell the story of this groundbreaking label. And to begin, we look back, but not too far back, at our live show this past June at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. It was part of BAM's collaboration with WNYC in a series called Radio Love Fest. And you can hear live sets that we presented by Hamilton Lighthouser and his band, plus the group San Fermin, at soundcheck.org. But in between those bands, we had a visit from former Daily Show correspondent Wyatt Cenac. The Brooklyn-based comic casts a gimlet eye at the foibles and idiosyncrasies of living in New York on his new album called Brooklyn, which is out now on vinyl only. Here is Wyatt Cenac from Soundcheck, live at BAM.
Thank you. Thank you. There's no way I'll live up to that. I take the subway a lot. I like taking the subway. I feel like you take the subway every now and again. I'll be waiting for the train, and the train will pull in, and there'll be one empty car. And if you've lived in New York for more than 3 days... you know, don't go into the empty car, because it smells. But every now and again, I'll find an empty car, and it won't stink. And I'll get really excited, and I'll just go inside it, and I'll hang out all day. I'll just clear my schedule and just take it, just live there. Because just at this point, it's really the only Manhattan real estate I can afford. And I've been on TV. But I'll just hang out, and it'll be great. I'll just have fun, and, like, I'll practice spinning around on those poles. Just because one of these days I am going to audition to be in one of those subway dance groups. Those kids that dance on the train, I always wonder if they also do that on airplanes. It's like, it's showtime, it's showtime! I can usually keep an empty subway car to myself for a few stops. People won't get in. It's one of the benefits of looking like homeless Tiger Woods. I like an empty train car, a crowded one. I don't like a crowded train car because it just everybody's bumping into you and just you never know what's going to happen. I'm always afraid to doze off on a crowded train. And it used to be I didn't want to doze off and wake up and miss my stop. And now it's, oh, I don't want to doze off and wake up and find myself on someone's Instagram feed. When did we all turn into f***ing shitty-ass spies just trying to take pictures of each other? You can't see this. Yes, I can. Nobody checks their email with a flash. Just rude, all these little snarky spies everywhere. Like, for all the people who were upset about the NSA invading our privacy, at least the NSA never took a picture of, like, a pregnant lady who fell asleep in her groceries and then put some comment on there like, nom, nom, nom. People assume I smoke a lot of pot because I talk kind of slow and I look like a high school jazz teacher. We're gonna skip today's lesson on octave notation, and I'm gonna tell you about that time I smoked Moroccan hash with Gil Scott Heron. Everybody assumes I smoke a lot of pot. Assumes it to the point that I'll do shows sometimes and people will show up after the show and hand me pot as though they were handing Gatorade to a marathon runner. Like, he needs it. He's gonna cramp up without it. I was in San Francisco. I did a show in San Francisco. And after the show, this guy brought me a Ziploc bag, like a gallon-sized Ziploc freezer bag, filled to the brim with weed, which is a really generous burden to place on me. Because I don't live in San Francisco. So now I have 3 days to move a shit ton of weed. You know what's fun? Being a somewhat recognizable TV personality turned drug dealer.
Oh, wow, man. Things really fell apart for you after The Daily Show. Give me an eighth.
I live in Brooklyn. It's very cool to be here. Yeah. That's called pandering. I have a stoop. I'd never had a stoop before. I like having a stoop. I like to sit on my stoop and watch people go by. I was on my stoop recently, and there was this woman, a mother, and she was pushing her kids in a stroller. She had a little one who was in a stroller, and there was another kid who was hanging off the back of the stroller, like on a little sissy bar, like they make little sissy bars for strollers now. So he's hanging off the back, and he was like a little kid. I don't know how old he was. I try not to be good at guessing a child's age, because it just, as a single guy with no children, I just feel like I don't want to be the guy that's like, no, that's an 8-year-old. Yeah. I'm certain, just turned. So I don't know, he was like a little kid. He was like, he couldn't drive. He was like little. And he's hanging off the back of the stroller and he's screaming his head off. And he's just screaming. He's like, I want to go back where we were. I want to go back where we were. And I'm watching this and I was like, wow. This little kid feels really strongly about gentrification. Stay strong, little soldier. And he's just like, I want to go back where we were. And his mother's like, Alexander, stop it. Stop it, Alexander. And he's like, I want to go back where we were. And then he just goes dead weight and just falls down on the sidewalk right in front of my stoop. And he's just there. And he does that thing that kids do when they realize, like, words aren't going to solve this, so let's make this a feat of strength. And he's just laying there, and his mother just looks at him, and she's just like, bye, Alexander.
Bye. Leaving you. And goes all the way home.
And she ain't lived next door. She lived, like, 8 doors down. And the whole way, bye, Alexander, bye-bye. Just leaves, goes into her apartment, just goes inside and leaves Alexander with me. I'm just looking at this kid. I'm like, this is not how Batman got Robin. I know this. And this kid, he's just there screaming his head off. I want to go back where we were. Only other person on the sidewalk is a construction worker. Construction worker walks out. He looks at me, I look at him, we're just kind of looking at each other. Some point, like, I don't know what's supposed to happen here. Do we just become the prototypical Brooklyn blended family? Like, he goes inside. Now it's just me and Alexander. Alexander's still yelling, but now he's not as passionate. He's gotten a rock and he's kind of drawing on the concrete. And he's just like, I want to go back where we were. I want to... It was like, go, go, you win. You win, go. And I want to leave, and I'm like, I can't leave because it's just him and me. Like, I'm the only person keeping this kid from running through traffic because, like, I don't know where his mom is. Like,
And I'm just now, like, watching this kid, and finally, after, like, 15 minutes, his mother finally comes out of the house, comes down the street, and just like, Alexander, come on, just picks him up and drags him home. Never looked at me to say thank you for babysitting my child. Didn't, like, offer me money or anything. Just like, that's not how you make a nanny. Like, you don't just find a brown person who's free at 2 on a Tuesday. Just hand him, like, make sure he eats his carrots. It's terrible. It's also, I read, it's bad to do that to children. It's bad if you're like, bye, I'm leaving you. Like, it's bad to do that because it breeds mistrust. Like, they wind up with trust issues. But more importantly, at some point, they'll get older, and then they'll take you someplace. Like an old folks home. And they'll be like, bye, I'm leaving you. All right, guys, thank you very much. This has been a lot of fun.
That's Wyatt Cenac performing live at BAM during Soundcheck's show at the Radio Love Fest, a little festival with WNYC and BAM this past June. Wyatt's new comedy album is called Brooklyn. It's out now on vinyl only. You can also watch Wyatt Cenac's comedy special of the same name on Netflix. Up next, the one and only Russell Simmons talks with us about 30 years of Def Jam Records, which at one point was based right here in the very same Manhattan building that WNYC calls home. That's right after the break on Soundcheck. Sup, some brothers pull some gas, so I said I'm stuck. These girls peeping me, I'm gonna glide and swerve. These hookers looking so hard, they straight hit the curve. Want to bigger, better things than some horny tricks. I see my homie and some suckers all in his mix. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. 20 years ago, Warren G hit it big with Regulate. It was a hit for him and, of course, for his record label, Def Jam Records. Def Jam was the famed hip-hop label founded by Russell Simmons and Rick Rubin, who had already brought us acts like Public Enemy, the Beastie Boys, and LL Cool J. A few months ago, Russell Simmons stopped by our studios to talk about the early days of Def Jam Records, celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. I started our conversation by reminding Russell that back in the 90s, Def Jam's offices were located right here in the very same Manhattan building where WNYC studios are.
I forgot.
This was Def Jam.
I just drove. My driver dropped me off. I know. You never told me that. This was Def Jam. This is 160 Varick Street.
This is where you used to.
Yeah. All right, this is the floor for, I mean, God knows. But that's funny.
Def Jam moved into this building in the 90s, right?
Yep.
By that point, how involved were you in the day-to-day running of Def Jam?
Every day. Every single day. You know, I was very involved early on.
Well, now I'm almost afraid to ask this next question, but how much do you remember of that
time? I remember all the moments that mattered, you know. I mean, I guess they all mattered, but, you know, I remember the artists that came through and the records that we made and the artists that we managed and during that time we were a management company and what I produced, of course, and what Rick produced that was special. And I remember a lot.
Yeah. Now, so, by the mid-90s, Rick Rubin had left Def Jam.
Well, artists he brought in. Like, in other words, he produced or helped produce the first Public Enemy record.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he produced the first LL Cool J record. He was, you know, very instrumental in setting a tone in this company. And so all that stuff kind of resonated still, you know.
Well, it's 30 years of Def Jam. Take me back to the early years. What was your role? I mean, Rick was the producer, as you say. What, you seem to have been the man about town when it came to hip-hop here in New York.
Before I met Rick, I produced quite a few records, including Rock Box. You know, Run DMC's first two albums, three albums. Boys up here perpetrating a fraud. You're out the cold whack and keep the crowd cold bored. You're the kind of guy that girl ignored. I'm driving Caddy, you fixing a Ford. My name is Joseph Simmons, but my middle name's Ward. And when I'm rocking on the mic, you should all applaud. Because we're really dealing, we got a funny feeling. We rock from the floor up to the ceiling. We groove it, you move it, it has been proven. We count the savage beats because our music is soothing. We create it, relate it, and up and demonstrate. We always tell the truth and then we never slip no lies. So I was, I don't know if I was a man about town. I had already been in rap. In other words, I had Run DMC, and I had Houdini, and I had the Feelers 4, and I had the Funky 4, and I had Jimmy Spicer, and I had, you know, I managed a lot of bands, Orange Crush, and there was a number of
them. Curtis Blow, too, right?
Curtis Blow, of course, yeah. So I managed all those bands before I met Rick, and then he liked Rockbox and King of Rock, and then he produced a record which really blew my mind. I heard it on the radio. It's Yours.
Commentating, illustrating, description giving, adjective expert, analyzing some of the musical myths, seeking people of the universe. This is yours. Do you like it?
Yeah.
Do you want it?
Yeah.
Well, if you had it, would you flaunt it?
Yeah.
Well, it's yours.
That's Tila Rock, and it was a Streetwise record owned by Arthur Baker, but the logo was Def Jam, the same logo that is so well known today, and that was something Rick created. And he produced the record, and I remember the lyrics to this: commentating, illustrating, description giving, adjective expert, analyzing, summarizing, musical myth seekers, people of the universe, this is yours, it's yours, it's yours. Remember? So that was his record that he produced, his first production, and it stood out like a sore thumb. It was such a brilliant piece of work in the midst of a lot of stuff that was not so great. And that was all stuff that was not so great was mine. I had a lot of records on the radio from the bands I managed, and it was all pretty good, but It's Yours was unique. And I sought out Rick. Red Alert gave me Jazzy J's number. Jazzy J brought Rick to me. I brought me to Rick. I met him in Danceteria. I'm like, where's the nigga who made that record? Jazzy C's right here. I said, no, but the nigga who made the record, he said he's right here. This nigga made that record? And it was Rick Rubin, who didn't look like the guy who was likely to make that record.
Yeah, yeah.
And we became friends. I went to his dorm.
He was still an NYU student, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Portly white kid student. And,
yeah, yeah.
Not what you would have expected.
No, I mean, that the age wasn't a thing. The fact that he had long hair and he was a white kid, you know, was shocking at the time. I went to his dorm, and he had... Back then, I had produced Suck MC already, and I had produced, you know, Hollis Crew and a lot of records that sounded a little bit like that. And so hearing a record stripped down, as bare as that, and as innovative as that, I used to look at it. If I could find a beat like Suck MC again, I'd have a hit. That was just that simple, a good rapper and a great beat. And Rick Rubin had a drum machine full of beats, a drum machine full of what I called hits, right? So he had that rhythmic thing happening and countless beats. Like, this is a beat-making machine, right? And then we partnered up. I became his manager, actually.
Right.
I managed him and the Beastie Boys.
Speaking with Russell Simmons, the co-founder with Rick Rubin of Def Jam Records, the label is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year, and Russell, of course, went on to found the HBO series Def Comedy Jam and Def Poetry Jam, and the influential fashion lines like Fat Farm and Baby Fat, and the website globalgrind.com. The important thing, Russell, about what you and Rick did was that you guys set up hip-hop not as black culture, but as youth culture.
Well, I've always been a person interested in diversity, and I mean that not, you know, in a way that a business guy can't survive without it, because they can't. Not in the next America, they should you know, be aware of it. It's just a big piece of potential for any business, you know, and certainly any creative business. You know, the integration of culture and the melting pot is really at work now. You know, I got to say that what we're seeing now is you know, still a lack of real understanding of it. But that's what we did. Rick and I loved culture, and it was colorless, you know, That was what we did then, and it's, you know, continue to do. I mean, I just left Kanye this second. I just left him sitting in the lounge at the Mercer Bar, and he's talking, and we're talking about how you know, Kim Kardashian made the Attorney General call me by tweeting about the prison industrial complex. I mean, we're talking about pop culture and integration and how kids are moving to a different beat, not segregated. Like, I live in Hollywood now.
Uh-huh.
So I'm making a bunch of movies, and all the movies, the way they cast them, even now you look at black movies and they're like calling cards, Hallmark cards for black people, and white people can't go. and there's still the first black girl, and this is just, I'm going to bring it home, but the first black girl on a drama since Julia is Scandal. And there ain't no Scandal without the black girl. But she's the first girl. Julia, you're just about old enough to know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Diane Carroll. So
and
the lack of integration.
Now you're talking about the ABC show.
Yeah, but Scandal. Yeah. But the lack of integration is still, and music is a place where we find it to be really in the forefront where, you know, Hollywood, the rest of the world is behind. But
right.
In music, you can't segregate people or separate them. And so for us, it was a way, you know, we worked together. We had a very strong common thread, Rick Rubin and I.
Well, and you had this, who had the stroke of genius idea of pairing Run DMC with Aerosmith?
Well, it was Rick's idea to get Aerosmith. It was Jay's idea to produce Toys in the Attic. Let me tell you what that is, a good story. Because Toys in the Attic,
which was the Aerosmith record.
Yeah, we didn't know what it was. We would scratch the names of the artists off the record. Because that way we cut in the record, that's our like you can watch me cut it all day long, but you don't know what it is. And we didn't know Aerosmith from A Can of Paint. We knew, we didn't know who Aerosmith was. We knew that beat. And by the time it would go, the guitar would play a little bit when we f***ed up. So you, in other words, you cut the beat back and forth and the rapper would rap. And then sometimes they go, rah! And that'd be cool. But when it goes down on that, that's too much. That means you're a whack DJ.
Uh-huh.
So we wasn't listening to the guitar riff, and we weren't interested. We thought we'd write a song that would fit on top of that beat, and perhaps Dinner would play, you know, mm-hmm. But we would also put other samples and create a record. This is the typical process,
right.
And this was a beat that we liked in the way that we liked Mardi Gras, Bob James, or jazz, or blues, or rock and roll. It didn't matter what it was, as long as the beat was, and we could do some fun stuff with the music. We never thought to use the music. And we didn't know who Aerosmith was. So we played it for Rick. He said, why don't we just get Aerosmith? And we said, get who? Well, you mean get Toys in the Attic? No, the band's name is Aerosmith. Oh, shit. Okay. So the name of the record is Toys in the Attic? No, the name of the album is Toys in the Attic.
Right.
We didn't like the rest of the album, so we understood that the group's name was Aerosmith and the record's name was Walk This Way through Rick. And then Rick, you know, since having grown up on them and loved them so much, it was a big thrill to him to have them in the studio, and well, at least have them in the bathroom in the studio because they were getting high the whole time. So, so having them in the bathroom and coming out and singing and stuff was a thrill to us.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that song. It's a classic bit of music history from Def Jam Records, co-founded by my guest Russell Simmons, and featuring Run DMC. Have I mentioned yet that Run is your brother, your younger brother, Joseph Simmons? Run DMC with Aerosmith and their version of Walk This Way. Just a little bit of Run DMC and Aerosmith and Breaking Down Walls, literally in the video, with their version of Walk This Way. Released on Def Jam Records, Russell Simmons and Rick Rubin co-founded the label 30 years ago. And Russell Simmons with me here in the Soundcheck studio. Russell's latest book is called Success Through Stillness, Meditation Made Simple.
It's kind of an off-subject thing. I know. I guess they told you have to say that. You know, I mean, Rick's a meditator. I'm a meditator.
I was just going to say, he's gotten
into 20 years,
too.
Rick
yeah.
for 30 years. So it's like, you know, Rick's probably longer than 30 years. I mean, he's been a meditator his whole life, and I've been a meditator for over 20 years. So I think it's appropriate to say, but kind of sounds off-subject, right? Are we talking about
is it off-subject? Or
I don't think at all. I think musicians and artists always, you know, operate from the inside out. As you know, don't let the noise on the outside stop them from innovating. And without stillness, you can't create.
Yeah.
And so that's why, you know, I like to share that idea, you know, with kids especially. But anyway, Let's get back to the music.
All right. Your co-founder, Rick Rubin, was recently a guest on our show Studio 360 down the hall here at WNYC. I want to play a clip of Rick Rubin talking about those early days when you guys founded Def Jam Records.
I was witnessing what was happening, and it felt like a magical time in music because there was this new energy, and it felt like very much like punk rock, but different. And I think the difference between hip-hop and punk rock was a lot of people rejected punk rock, whereas a lot of people accepted hip-hop.
What do you think of that, Russell?
That's pretty much, that's, you know, I can imagine that that would come out. I've heard Rick say stuff like that, and it's absolutely true. I mean, there was a moment that punk rock and hip-hop, we went on tour with Curtis Blow in 1980, I guess it was, with the Clash. I mean, we played the Peppermint Lounge and the Mud Club and the Ritz and, you know, the World and all the downtown places that all the punk rock clubs, punk rock artists performed as well. We were not accepted early on from anybody but the punk rock and the real urban community. In other words, not even the urban community liked us, really. The truth is they hated us. You know, black, record executives, black, you know, executives of any kind or any kind of anybody who was not stuck in the hood and didn't understand why the voice was so important. They really rejected it. It reminded them of realities that they were trying to escape.
Both maybe personally and in the music they were producing?
Well, the music itself, you know, pushed buttons in black people that they didn't like. You know, black radio was like all music and no rap.
Yeah.
You know, they used to say,
I remember that.
All music and no rap. Yeah, they didn't like rap music and they didn't like the rap artists because it was the underbelly of society. We gave voice to the voiceless. And so at that moment, it was, only punk rock and only the alternative and the fun, you know, critics, the Village Voice critics poll would always pick rap records as number one or top five. The top five, it'd be three rap records. You know,
right.
And that no one ever heard of except the hip-hop community and the punk rock community.
And look how quick it was, you know, when the punk rock and the hip-hop communities came together. You mentioned Curtis Blow with The Clash, and then there was Afrika Bambaataa with Johnny Rotten, you know, doing Planet World Destruction.
Right.
You know, so the two worlds were sort of coming together
Public Enemy
pretty
and Anthrax
early on.
Performed too, that's rock, but there's a lot of different rap collaboration because they're both alternative to, in the sense that they were breaking rules and they were youth culture at its best, or you know, where it was more freedom in the music, you know, and I think that was what they had a common thread.
And with the Beastie Boys, you had somebody who sort of, you know,
They were young and useless, or useless youth, and they were a punk rock band and they were a rap band at the same time, you know. So there was that. It was that whole experience of, you know, playing, you know, Danceteria and the Mud Club and the Ritz. And that also, it influenced hip-hop a little, influenced punk a lot, and influenced, you know, it gave light to the hip-hop music. And that, you know, it always, you know, it comes from somewhere, right? It has to come from some alternative to be the mainstream. The alternative became the mainstream. In rap's case, where in punk rock it didn't quite go, but some of the alternative, some of the punk rock artists became mainstream, you know. But the rap artists, we had a few that became mainstream, but they were not the core of what became hip hop. In other words, you know, you'd have a Vanilla Ice and you'd have a this and you have a pop record, but then those artists would have not compromised, but their version of hip-hop was not as in the center of what the cultural movement was.
Right.
The center of the cultural movement is on pop radio today.
Well, you guys, you know, you unleashed Public Enemy and LL Cool J and a lot of figures who were central in bringing this alternative music and making it mainstream.
Yeah, we were there.
Let me ask you, the phrase keeping it real, is that something that grew up at Def Jam? Did you guys...
It's something that I brought... It's from the street. It was what we did. It was a mantra that rappers did. You know, even though they said, well, why do you want money? Why are you singing about your new Big Mac, or why are you singing about your new Adidas, or your, you know, what shoes you wear?
Yo, what's up, my Adidas? Standing on 25th Street, funky fresh, and yes, cold on my feet. With no shoes, string in them. I did not win them. I bought them off the app with the black lead. I like to bought them.
you commercialize these things, because that's what we from the hood, we want it. We're not rejecting. We wanted the American dream, just as jazz and blues and rock and roll artists. Originally, Chuck Berry had an orange car and an orange Cadillac to match. You know, I mean, they wanted stuff. They wanted the American dream. And rappers are no different. Coming out of the hood, they want the stuff that they see. They want it all, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you know, it's an American aspiration. And they say, I want it too. Mm-hmm. So they rapped about that stuff. And so it was never a sellout. It was an honest aspiration. And they were inspired. You know, it didn't, of course, those things didn't help them become better artists. In fact, in many cases, it ruined their careers.
So were you a victim of your own success at Def Jam, you know, sort of bringing hip-hop into the mainstream, especially in the 90s? Did things change? Did the business change? Did you feel things were getting away from you?
Not really. I enjoyed the whole process. I mean, there were times when we sold more records, times when we sold less. I kind of viewed them back. Now I look at them as the same. I enjoyed this whole ride. I don't have a lot of bad recollections of, you know, there were moments where there was struggle, but I don't think it was that the entire thing got away. I hate to say it, it doesn't make for a good movie. They licensed my book for the fourth time to make a movie again, and I'm kind of telling them, let the writer figure out where the struggle was. And I've enjoyed this whole ride. You know, I had the most beautiful friends and people and support systems and executives that, you know, have gone mm-hmm. on there, you know, the Leo Cohens and Kevin Lyles and Julie Greenwald and Mike Cott, all became presidents of different companies. Rick Rubin became the greatest producer in the history of music, the most profound, the guy. Melody's king in Rick's mind. He can hear it all. He can play Slayer and Krishna Das back to back. It'll make a difference to him.
Def Jam Records celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. Russell, of course, also the founder of Def Comedy Jam and Def Poetry Jam. His latest book is Success Through Stillness, Meditation Made Simple. Russell, a great pleasure to have you with us today on Soundcheck.
My pleasure.
That's the Slayer song, Angel of Death, from their album, Rain in Blood, which, yes, was released by Def Jam Records back in 1986. That was the label's first and only signing of a thrash metal band. Up next, live music from the Australian band called Little May. Stay with us. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. It's CMJ week here in New York, with over 1,000 bands from all around the world clamoring for our attention. It can be hard to stand out from such a big crowd, but one group that's managed to do that, at least for me, is this Australian band called Little May. Their sound is built around some wonderful and occasionally eerie three-part harmonies and some darkly cinematic accompaniment. Their self-titled EP is just out, and they're going to play some of it for us today. With their song Dust, here is Little May, live on Soundcheck.
Thank you.
The band is called Little May from Sydney, Australia, playing live here in our New York studio, and that song is called Dust. Little May is built around the three-part harmonies of Liz Drummond, Hannah Field, and Annie Hamilton. Annie also playing the electric guitar and Liz playing the acoustic guitar. And Mark Harding on bass, Cat Hunter behind our drum kit here in the Soundcheck studio. Little May is the name of the band and also the name of their self-titled EP, which is out now. And Liz Drummond, to you and the rest of the band, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having us.
I really like the sound of these songs. I mean, not just the sound of the band, but the storytelling as well. I mean, it seems like each of these songs is a genuine piece of storytelling.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's taken a few years of us to kind of work together and figure out how to tell stories together and individually. So, yeah, I think when we write, it's definitely a piece of us and a sort of story that we've you know, been through.
Well, there's, you know, people who are familiar with American folk and country and Appalachian music know there's often a kind of a dark undercurrent to a lot of what seems like very angelic singing. Is that the case for you guys too?
Yeah, definitely. We've always been sort of drawn to dark music and I've always loved a lot of you know, like Black Sabbath and Led Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, sort of darker music, and mm-hmm. I think we all kind of like that as well. And I know, like, our music is a bit, it can be quite delicate and angelic, but I think there is definitely a darkness, and I think it's probably going to come out a lot more as we progress.
Mm. Now, you know, here we have like the Southern Gothic, you know, in literature, and in Appalachia we have the murder ballads and stuff. Is there anything comparable happening, you know, in Australian literature and in Australian music? I mean, I guess there's Nick Cave, right?
Yeah,
that's pretty dark.
Yeah. I don't know. I think who else is there in Australia that's quite dark? I can't really think of anybody at the moment.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I don't know. Courtney Barnett's, do you know her stuff?
She's doing quite well over here. Yeah, she's quite dark.
There's a little subversive streak to some
definitely.
Of her music. Yeah. So where does that come from for you guys? Did you grow up listening to, you know, English murder ballads, Appalachian folk songs, any of that kind of stuff?
No, I know I personally didn't. I don't think any of the girls did. I think we just kind of grew up with kind of what our parents listened to, which is like Fleetwood Mac and, you know, all the classics. But I think we probably don't even know half of the influences, you know, that where we got.
Because you're getting them secondhand.
Yeah.
So did the three of you start as a vocal group? Was that the original idea?
Yeah, we did. We started just the three of us. Originally, it was just Hannah and I back in high school. And then we got Annie on board because we wanted a lead guitarist. So, yeah, but now we have our lovely drummer, Kat, and Mark, who's our keyboard and bass player.
Yes, you're token male in the band.
Yeah.
Very nice of you. the sound has grown then for the EP and for the current tour, and you're suggesting that maybe this is still a work in process, work in progress?
I think so. We might be heading in a bit more of a rocky route, but I'm not sure. You know, it can always change. When we go to the studio, we could do anything. It might end up being dance music or...
Really?
I don't know.
A three-part harmony. I'd like to hear that.
Me too, actually.
The band is Little May, which, I mean, just that name sounds like, you know, there's Little Margaret, there's Little Maggie. I mean, there's all kinds of folk songs. Were you trying to evoke that with the band name?
Not at all, actually. I think we just kind of thought of the name and it just stuck. I think my mum suggested it, and then there was a theory that we mixed our dogs' names together, the letters of our dogs' names, but I think we don't really know where it came from.
Well, wherever it came from, it's the name of the band and the EP that's out now. Having heard Dust, you want to do Hide for us next?
Sure, we'd love
right.
to.
The band is here in town for CMJ Week. They've got a Friday night gig, a late night gig, after this segment broadcasts at the Mercury Lounge. And then on Saturday, an afternoon show at Pianos at 1:30 p.m. And then a late night on Saturday at the Delancey. They'll be playing shortly after midnight. So a busy weekend ahead for Little May. Right now they're here in the Soundcheck studio, and they're going to play this song called Hide.
Taking steps toward your door, I hadn't let myself before. I hear your name call, she screams your name call, as you take a to the floor. She likes it.
That again is the band Little May here in the Soundcheck studio, and a song called Hide from the band's self-titled EP, which is out now. Once again, Liz Drummond, Hannah Field, and Annie Hamilton all singing. Annie's playing electric guitar, Liz playing the acoustic guitar, Cat Hunter behind the drum kit, Mark Harding playing bass, and on that song, keyboards. Liz, you guys are here in town, as are so many other musicians this week, for CMJ,
yeah.
Which is this kind of enormous just sprawl.
Yeah.
How do you navigate that?
I don't think we even know how to.
So you just go wherever you're pushed.
Yeah, yes, pretty much. Yeah, we're starting today, so I'll let you know how it goes. Mm-hmm. But I think it's going to be a pretty amazing experience.
What do you hope to get out of a week like this when it's all said and done?
I think just experience. You know, we're so lucky that we are able to play this festival. I think we're all still gobsmacked that we're here in New York.
This is your first time here?
Yes. Mm-hmm. This is my first time, I think. Actually, it's all of our first times. So, yeah, we've been very, very excited about the whole thing.
Right. Now, you're all from Sydney. The band is from Sydney, right?
Yes.
I know Melbourne has like a really huge, vibrant music scene. Adelaide has its own thing, AC/DC and all that stuff. What's going on in Sydney? What's the music scene like there?
At the moment, it's really cool. I think there's a lot of awesome music coming out of Australia at the moment. And I think Sydney in particular is, doing very well. We have a lot of bands that we've played with that have really inspired us, and there's lots of great talent coming out of Sydney. So I think, Melbourne's got their own thing and everyone does. And Sydney's definitely got something going on.
Is there a sort of New York-Boston rivalry thing going on between Sydney and Melbourne or not really?
Perhaps, yeah. I think there's a little
bit of
something.
There's a gleam in your eye when you say that.
Yeah. Actually, I think we all are sort of... We've been to Melbourne, we've done a few gigs, and we're like, oh, this is actually pretty cool. So we might, turn into Melbourneites.
Okay, so The way lots of bands move to Brooklyn here.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
but for the moment, Little May is based in Sydney and spending a week here in New York for the CMJ Festival. I'm sure you guys are having a field day here in New York, and I'm really glad you've taken some time to join us today in the Soundcheck studio.
This has been awesome. We've loved this. This is great.
So you have a new song to play us out with?
We do. We have a new song. It's called Shotgun. So we're going to play that for you.
The band is Little May, and as I say, very busy week for them. A late night Friday show right after we broadcast this segment happening at the Mercury Lounge as part of the CMJ Festival. And then two gigs on Saturday. They're at Pianos at 1:30 in the afternoon, and then at the Delancey at a little bit after midnight on Saturday. Right now, Little May here with us on Soundcheck with a new song called Shotgun.
James was telling secrets and you held my fingers as you drive me away. Tie me up again, bright me. Thank you.
from Australia, the band Little May with a brand new song called Shotgun. Their self-titled debut EP is out now. On our next show, we look at the 7-week streak of female domination on the pop charts. For the first time ever, female solo artists have held all 5 top spots on the Hot 100 for more than 4 weeks in a row, and we'll take a listen to their hit songs. And we'll talk with author Jonathan Lethem about the new musical adaptation of his 2003 novel, Fortress of Solitude, and a live set from the band James. James became one of the biggest bands in the UK in the early 90s with hits like Sit Down and Sound, and one of the best songs ever about sex, Laid. After a hiatus in the early 2000s, James reunited and they've released a string of albums. Their latest is called La Petite Mort. That's on Monday's show. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Katie Bishop, Dan O'Donnell, and Mike Katziff, with Henry Malofsky and Amy Pearl. Our interns are Haley Shaw, Bailey Constance, and Cooper Mackey. That does it for today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.